Hi, I'm Johanna Ferreira, content director of Pop Sugar Juntos. Juntos is all about celebrating Latinx culture, pride, our many intersectional identities, and joy. Thanks to support from Prime, there's so much to get into over at Juntos this month. From conversations with the Latinx minds behind our favorite new movies and resurrected TV shows, to thoughtful celebrity commentary and exclusive interviews with some of the biggest Latin music artists today. And it doesn't stop there. Get more of the music, movies, and shopping you love on Prime. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more of whatever you're into from streaming to shopping. And get all of our latest coverage at popsugar.com/juntos. Con amor, Johanna.
Welcome to The Cut on Tuesdays on Thursday. I'm Stella Bugby, editor-in-chief of The Cut.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life.
This is How I Get It Done, The Cut series about ambitious women and how they live, how they deal with their inboxes, people's feelings, their grocery shopping, their morning routines. It's part advice column, part love letter, part voyeurism. This week I spoke with Tamara Mellon, who founded the luxury shoe brand Jimmy Choo in the 90s. Back then, Jimmy Choo was a kind of Sex and the City sort of shoe. Tamara designed many of those shoes, and rich and famous women wore them. And just a few years after starting that company, she was rich and famous herself. She told me that fame wasn't completely new to her, though. Her mother had been a model in England, and her father held a very unusual place in show business.
I read that your dad was a stunt double for Rock Hudson. Is that true?
They looked identical.
Wow. When,
yes.
Handsome.
My dad was a very handsome guy. He was 6'4", very handsome. And he was his stunt double before he went into business. He was really young. He was in his 20s when he did that.
Okay.
And at that time, he was also dating, there was a very famous British actress called Diana Dawes. She was like the Marilyn Monroe of the UK. Mm. And he was dating her.
Your dad was.
Yes.
So she could have been your mom.
That would have been, yeah.
And your mother was also a model, right?
My mother was a model. She was a model in the 60s. Yeah. She was quite a big model in the 60s.
Did you see your parents a lot as a child?
You know, I grew up, so I had a kind of a strange mix in my childhood. So I lived in the UK until I was 8, and then we moved to Beverly Hills. I lived in Beverly Hills from when I was 8 until I was 16, and then we moved back to the UK.
And what precipitated that move?
My father was the CEO of Fidel Sassoon, and he took over Fidel Sassoon when they had one salon in London. He was friends with Fidel, and Fidel said to him, you know, I have this salon that's packed, but I can't make money. And so my dad bought into the business and became the CEO. And then in the 70s, they decided to move the head offices to L.A. And we all moved out to L.A.
Did you have a crazy haircut as a child?
I've had some strange haircuts as a child. Yes, I definitely had the great Sassoon bob. Yeah. And I remember actually, you know, I grew up in the salons and I remember, you know, we used to like hang out in the salons. I spent a lot of time in there as a kid.
My grandmother was a hairstylist and used to inflict those Vidal Sassoon haircuts on me as a child. It was traumatic, I have to say.
Yeah. And they literally developed the shampoo in a friend's garage, put some almond scent in it.
So we'll get back to this in a second, but it sounds like your father gave you the model for what your future business moves might be like.
Yeah, my father was definitely my mentor. And what was interesting, you know, growing up, he didn't treat me any differently than my brothers. I had the same amount of pressure to work and to do something. And, you know, my dad loved business. He was a true entrepreneur. And so the family discussions at the dinner table were always around business. So I guess just growing up, you absorb it.
So did you always know I'm going to be a businesswoman?
I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I was a very troubled teen. My mother was completely insane, was alcoholic and Valium addict and like crazy behavior when we were growing up. So I did terribly in school. I left school with no qualifications. I didn't even graduate high school if you compare it to like America. And I didn't go to college. And so I always loved fashion, right? So, and as a young girl, I would play with clothes, and at school, I would do makeovers. And in those days, they weren't even called makeover. We didn't know what to call them, but I would, you know, restyle people and do their makeup. And I just knew I wanted to be in the fashion business, but I didn't know how or what I would do. I got a job at a multi-brand store in London called Browns, and I worked on the shop floor.
What did you learn on the shop floor?
You know what? I hated it when I was doing it. I was like, I don't want to be here. I want to be doing something else. And then when I founded Jimmy Choo, I realized how valuable that was because I knew how to do everything in the store. You learn how to organize the stock room. You learn how to serve a customer. You know, when Jimmy Choo opened, I served customers. I cleaned the store. I did everything. So,
because you had to, or because you felt that that was something you needed to know how to do to run the business better?
Oh, because I had to. We were on a very tight budget.
Let's go through your actual trajectory. So you were working at Browns, and then where'd you go?
From there, I worked for a PR firm, and I was there for about a year. And then I realized there was a magazine opening in London called Mirabella.
Was that the UK version of the American Mirabella?
Yes. Yeah.
And what year was that?
1989.
And Ken, most people are not familiar with Mirabella and the beauty of that magazine. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
So Grace Mirabella left Vogue, and she was the founder of her own magazine, which was very successful in the US. So they decided to launch it in the UK. I remember when I was working at the PR company, hearing about it and then reading all the literature they were sending out about it. And I thought, you know what, this is, I want to be on the other side of the fence. I want to be a fashion editor rather than pushing, you know, the product to get people to write about it. I want to be on the side deciding what I'm going to write about. So I applied to be the assistant to the fashion editor, who is actually a very famous fashion editor called Caroline Baker. And she was one of the creative people at Nova and did like really pioneering shoots. And to my shock, she chose me.
So why do you think she chose you?
I don't know. I think, you know, that was one of my first lessons. I really researched the magazine and the philosophy and the type of woman it was and what they wanted to write about. And I really researched what they were looking for and studied it. And so I was very prepared when I went in for the interview.
What's something that you learned at Mirabella? I'll just assume that you took something from every place that we're going to talk about. So what's something that you took from Mirabella?
So, you know, working for Caroline was a great experience. I really learned how to pull a shoot together, style a shoot, be organized, call things in, book things in and out. So I really learned how to be a fashion assistant in that job. Unfortunately, it folded while I was there. It didn't last. And when it folded, I actually got a call from Vogue. Said the fashion director here at Vogue is looking for an assistant. Will you come in for an interview? So I ended up, obviously did a good enough job. I ended up getting headhunted.
What was your favorite shoot you did?
We went trekking in the Himalayas. We had Sherpas carrying Vogue trunks up, you know, the Himalayas. And we walked, you know, 7 hours all day, you know, to get to one location to take a picture.
Who was the photographer?
That was Peter Lindbergh.
Yeah. That's a very famous photo shoot.
That was amazing. You know, we shot with Herb Ritts on the beach in Malibu. We shot with Patrick Demarchelier. And, you know, it was a very special time.
Did you feel at the time that it was special? Were you aware that it was special?
At the time, you don't realize that you're working with like these, when I look back at these incredible photographers, and it was also the day of the supermodel. Mm. So we worked with, you know, Helena Christensen and Christy Turlington and, you know, and Elle Macpherson and Cindy Crawford. And, you know, it was all the supermodels.
at that time in your life, were you still partying a lot? Was it still a big part of your life?
I didn't get sober till 1995, so I had 6 more years of partying at that point. But you know, I was what you call a functional addict. You know, I could go out and still show up for work, and I guess you can do that when you're young.
What were you addicted to?
So I was addicted to alcohol, cocaine. But to be honest with you, anything you gave me, ecstasy. You know, anything you gave me, I would have taken it.
And that was sort of part of that culture.
It's in the fashion industry, but I didn't take it because I was in the fashion industry. I would have taken it anyway.
Right.
So I can't really blame it on the industry or say it was because I was in the fashion industry.
So you're 21 at that time. What's your personal life like aside from you're partying a lot?
Well, that's about it. Partying, working. And then eventually, so I was at Vogue for 5 years, and I became the accessories editor. And then that's how I discovered Jimmy Choo.
So you were reporting on Jimmy?
It was an interesting story. So you probably don't remember, you're too young, but in the early 90s, there was one shoe designer. It was called Manolo Blahnik.
Yes.
So really, there wasn't a lot of choice. And there was a cobbler in the East End called Jimmy Choo. He wasn't designing collections. He wasn't selling the collections anywhere. But if you went down to his studio, he could make a pair of shoes. Mm. So he was making shoes for the local flea market. And he was making shoes. He had a few private clients, but it was very basic. It was like you could come in and you could get a pump or you could get a slingback. And he would make it in a matching color to go with lady blah blahs, you know, ball gown. That was about it. So I'd go down to his studio and I'd sit with him and we'd make things for shoots. I'd say, okay, Jimmy, I'm doing a gladiator story and I want a gladiator sandal and I want it in silver metallic and I want studs here. And so he'd make it, I'd photograph it and I'd put his name in Vogue. And there were other fashion editors doing this at the same time from other magazines. So his name became known, but there was absolutely no business at all. I mean, the place that he worked, I mean, it was like a Dickensian disused garage, which was, you know, now the area and Hackney has been gentrified, but it was like going to the meatpacking district in the early 80s. It was really dangerous. I mean, his assistant got mugged for her Chinese takeaway.
So if somebody saw those gladiator sandals in Vogue, they couldn't buy them?
They'd have to special order them.
Okay.
And he would do a home visit, or you could go to his studio, which was probably not recommended, but he did home visits.
So at what point did you have the idea, oh, this guy might be a good investment for me?
Well, I thought, I thought having the name in Vogue all the time, there was name recognition for sure. So I thought, what a great platform to start a business company. The name is known, but there's absolutely no business there. So my idea was, I went to him and I said, look, I will raise the money to do this. We'll become 50-50 partners. I'll find factories in Italy to produce the goods. I can do everything. So I can do the PR. I can wholesale the collection. I can open stores. All you have to do is design the collection. So I went and I borrowed £150,000 from my father, which is probably like $300,000 in today's US currency. And we became 50-50 partners. But in the beginning, I was still thinking Jimmy was going to design the collection. And so I kept saying to Jimmy, okay, I've found a couple of factories. Where are the sketches? Where are the sketches? And the sketches never arrived. And then I got so desperate, I even offered to pay him £1,000 for a sketch. And the sketches still never arrived. And then the penny dropped. I was like, oh my God, I was designing the shoe. I didn't even realize it. And so I said, you know what? I cannot lose my father's money. I was literally up at night sweating with anxiety about losing my dad's money. And I was like, I cannot do it. I'm going to have to do this. So his niece was working for him in the studio. And I said, you know, can you come and can you sketch? I said, can you put my thoughts on paper? She said, yes. So I would just spew out all my ideas. She would sketch them up. And then we'd take the sketches to the factory in Italy.
What would have happened if you had lost your father's money?
I would have been mortified. It's much worse.
So it was mostly just embarrassment.
Yeah, and it would have hurt him financially.
Yeah. Did he expect you to pay him back?
I did pay him back. Well, he was a shareholder in the company. And he said it was the best investment out of all the investments he ever made in his life. He made more money out of that company than anything else.
Nice.
Yes. So it was a good outcome.
Were you sober yet? Or were you still
yes. So
struggling?
95. So I was at Vogue for 5 years. 95, I had the idea to start the company. But then I got fired from Vogue because the partying was out of control. So I was getting to the point where I was really tired, and I was coming in late, kind of going home early, couldn't get it together. And I remember I walked in one day and I was late again, and there was this amazing woman called Anna Harvey, who recently passed away. And she was deputy editor, and she called me into her office, and she was very British about it. And she said, "Tamara, we think you've outgrown your job."
Did you understand that to mean what it meant?
I totally understood what she was saying. And I just went, I had the worst hangover of my life. And I was like, I was just so relieved to go home and get back into bed.
And how did that feel? What did you think?
So that first day, I was like so relieved I could just go home and get back into bed. And then I was like panicked. I was like, it was the fear that I needed to motivate me. I called Jimmy and went and took a meeting with Jimmy. And I said, this is my plan, right? And then I remember saying to him, I'm just going away for a month, traveling for a month, and I'll be back. And when I did, I went and checked myself into rehab.
Wow, did you tell anybody you were checking
yourself
into rehab?
I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell a soul because I didn't want...
You didn't tell your family?
I told my parents, who did not understand. And they said, if you go to rehab, you'll be branded a junkie and no one will ever want to talk to you again.
Wow.
Yeah, they just didn't get it. And I guess there was a lot of shame and stigma for that generation around admitting that anything was wrong. And I didn't tell any of my friends. I didn't want them to try and persuade me not to do it. So I went and I checked in by myself. And
did you ever think you might not get sober?
You know, the as soon as I got fired, I knew I had to get sober. I was scared enough. I was really, you know, you need to be scared enough to make a change. And I thought, well, where is my life going to end up? What am I going to be doing? I'm going to be in my 30s. I'm going to be broke. I'm going to have, like, no one in my life. I'm going to be single. I'm not going to have kids. I'm like, the fear exploded.
You're sober. You come back from your stint. You have your father's money. And then how long does it take to get those shoes in stores?
So I came out in September 95. And then the following spring in 97, we had a collection out.
And that was the collection you had designed?
And that was a collection, yeah, that I had designed. And
how did it feel to see your collection?
Well, the first one didn't work so well. And then I went back to the drawing board and I started to do research. This was another lesson about doing research. I started to, like, vintage shop. I started to put mood boards together and started to create stories. And then those were the shoes that really took off. So spring 98 was a breakthrough moment. I remember Saks coming in to see the collection and ordering, like putting in a big order, and literally wanted to like go and crack open the champagne afterwards. That was such
but
a breakthrough.
Couldn't,
but I
right?
couldn't.
So what did you do to celebrate?
So no, I don't remember what we did to celebrate, but that was a big breakthrough for us.
Did you call your dad?
Absolutely.
And what did
my
say?
Dad used to call me every day.
Really?
I mean, yeah, he was like, what are the numbers today? You know, he'd check the numbers every day.
Is your dad alive?
Unfortunately, he passed away in 2004, and he was chairman of Jimmy Choo until he passed away.
Oh. And is your mom alive as well?
She is alive.
Were they married the whole time?
Yes. They were married 40 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did they ever say they were proud of you in the end?
My dad did. My mother didn't.
Really?
No, my mother's a very unwell person, and she would, I think, actually, like, extreme
Still?
Narcissist, yes.
Yeah.
And she would actually tell people that she ran Jimmy Choo and that she would just send me out as a PR stunt.
How did that feel?
Terrible. Terrible.
How did you deal with that when somebody
crushing.
Would tell you that story?
You know what? That kind of thing is absolutely crushing because you work so hard and all you want is approval from your parents. But I definitely, you know, I think in life, if you have one good parent, you're okay. I had one amazing parent.
So Jimmy Choo is chugging along. Were you married yet?
In 2001, yes, I was married. I was only married a year.
How did you meet your husband?
I met him through friends in the program, in AA.
So did you stay in AA? You're still in it.
I'm still in it.
How often do you attend
24
meetings?
24 years.
24 years.
Yeah.
Wow. What would you say to someone who might need to hear that they needed to go to AA?
Every situation is different, you know, and I really believe that the opposite of addiction is connection. So there used to be this idea about tough love. Don't talk to the addict, cut them off, bring them to their knees, make it painful enough for them to get better. And I don't really believe that's the way. I think if someone was using, I'd probably go over and I'd probably just sit with them.
Mm-hmm. How many children do you have?
I have one child.
And what's her name?
She's called Minty Melon. And she's 16, about to turn 17.
And how has it been raising her?
I split up with Matthew, her dad, when she was one in 2003. Up until 2 years ago, it was very much Minty and I together. But I was a single mother until I met my partner, Michael.
What's she like?
Minty is, it can make me cry to talk about my daughter. Minty's just an incredible kid. She's really bright. She's really kind. She's much more mature and much more thoughtful than I was at her age.
Did you feel like you had to make up for the kind of mother you had?
Yes. I absolutely wanted to be a very, very different mother. And I know that sometimes I look and I'm like, oh God, I did that so wrong. Or, you know, I mean, but hopefully, like Minty, she feels loved. She feels love from me, which is what I never felt.
Do you ever talk to her about your childhood and the way
all
it affects
time.
Her childhood?
I'm very, very, very honest with her. Yeah.
When your mom would take credit for the company, did you ever confront her? How did you guys resolve that?
So I haven't spoken to my mother since 2005. We actually ended up in a court case in a lawsuit. So last time I saw her was in 2009 in court.
How does it feel not to speak to your mother?
You know, people will say to me, well, don't you want to reconcile? And I'm like, you know, it's very hard to reconcile with somebody that's never loved you. Right. So I don't feel a loss. I think I mourned it while I was in it, because when you're younger and you want your parents' approval and their love and you never get it. So I think I probably mourned that in it. And then when I decided to actually cut myself off, it was actually just a huge relief that I didn't have to deal with the drama, the insanity, the problems all the time.
Coming up, Tamara explains what it was like to start her professional life all over again at 44, and what it's like to cry uncontrollably at yoga.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome back to The Cut on Tuesdays on Thursdays. I'm talking with Tamara Melon. She's the founder and shoe designer at TamaraMelon.com, a website that sells luxury shoes direct to consumers. Back in the 90s, she co-founded the luxury shoe brand Jimmy Choo. The company was wildly successful, but in 2011, she sold her stake in the company. She says private equity firms that had invested over the years had changed the culture and the shoes so much that she walked away from the company she founded.
I sold Jimmy Choo in 2011. And I really left at the end because I wanted to create a very different type of company with a very different culture. Having private equity in it for so long and four different firms, it became a culture that I just wasn't proud of, because it became all about, you know, margins, profits, where I felt, you know, the profits were very healthy. You didn't need to squeeze it anymore. It was more about taking care of people. You know, all the people were burnt out, underpaid. The quality of the goods went down, that we were told to use cheaper leather all the time. And so I became embarrassed to stand next to the product. And the culture became very much sort of like a boys' club. And so I thought, you know what, I'm just young enough to leave and start again.
How old were you?
So I was 44 when I left.
Why did you feel that you were just young enough? What about 44 would have been?
I don't know. I felt like, you know, it's hard to start again as you get older. You know,
why do you think?
You know, it takes an enormous amount of energy to start something. It's like a Herculean effort to get something off the ground.
So how did you gather the fearlessness to do it again?
You know, it was really more about my soul, that I knew I had to do it. I didn't want what Jimmy Choo had become internally to be the legacy that I left. And I wanted to create a company with a very different culture, a culture that supported women, was a kinder culture, and also a culture that really cared about the customer as well. And I had to find a team of believers, right? I had to have people that really believed in me and believed in this.
A team of believers. I like that term. How does one go about finding that team?
It's hard. I mean, my CEO, I knew when I met her. I was like, I have to work with this woman. She's such a rock star. Yeah. So I wanted a female CEO because I wanted to build a female team.
Why?
You know, I realized that there's so many myths about women in business that are just not true.
Like what?
So she's a diva. She's a bitch. She's difficult. If she's successful, she's got to be difficult.
Like the leader of the company you're
yes.
speaking about. Yeah.
You know, and I always felt there was this, with the private equity that I was working with at Jimmy Choo, there was this fear around me. And, you know.
Fear that you couldn't handle the leadership position? Or what was the fear?
Fear of just me being a woman. They were like, well, how can somebody be that successful, that young? And I'm just going to say this, I'm going to put it out there. You know, when I look back at pictures of myself, I'm like, actually, you were really attractive. I never knew it at the time. I had no idea. I wish I'd known. And I'm like, oh, wow, you were really attractive when you were young. You know, and, you know, whenever I put an idea out, it was like, it was sort of double checked with the men. Is this a good idea? It was a very patronizing attitude. It was a very like boys club.
And this was the investors?
Those were the private equity company and the investors. And if you think, I had 10 of them on my board. I was the only woman on the board. I just think there was a historical bias, probably that they were not even conscious of.
Being in a room full of men as the only woman on the board, how did you psych yourself up to deal with that?
Not well. I was very stressed. I had a lot of anxiety. You know, I just had a lot of confusion of why are they so tough on me? Like, why are they being so rude to me all the time? Why are they being so aggressive with me all the time? Like, what is it?
Did you dress differently for those board meetings? Did you ever think about your appearance or your self-presentation and how that might affect your reception in the room?
I dressed very feminine. I didn't dress more masculine to go to them.
Jimmy Choo was an incredibly sexy brand. You know,
yes.
I associate it with some of the sexiest photographers of the time. And the campaigns were not deviant, but like definitely Helmut Newton inflected.
Yeah, who's one of my favorite photographers, yeah.
And it seems like that was a big part of the identity. What role has sex played in your life in terms of how it informed that brand, but just like, how do you think about sex?
So I guess, well, it was at a time, I launched the company in what is now called the Naughty 90s, right? So that was what it was all about at the moment. I mean, to express my sexuality, I always found that I wanted to show a woman, though, in a very empowered place in it and not in a submissive role look like she's an object. So if you look at Helmut Newton's work, the woman is very strong. And
interestingly, in Helmut Newton's work, shoes and high heels play
a part. Like a
large part in the sexuality of those images. For those of you who are not familiar with Helmut Newton's work, it's very S&M inflected. The shoe itself seems to be an object of fetish in the photography itself. And then there's a complicated relationship between the woman wearing those shoes and the way she's depicted in those photographs that I think translates to Jimmy Choo. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that dominance, the female dominance, the high heel, the way that you thought about that.
Well, I always wanted the woman, when I was designing for the woman or creating the images, like I said, I always wanted her to be strong. Like, you would never see an image where she looks submissive. And I think that's what Jimmy Choo was about. You know, it was very much, you know, it was a part of me, like my blood and sweat, ran through that business. And it was very much my vision, my creative vision. And, if you look at the Tamara Mellon brand today, you can see the images that we create of women, you know, they're very powerful women.
How do you think a powerful woman needs to present herself?
Confidence. I think it's internal.
Can it be cultivated?
Absolutely.
How?
I have become a lot more confident. And I think, I guess you just become more confident as you get older because you just don't give a shit anymore. Right? You become more rebellious as you get older because you don't care. There's a lot of ways. And here's one of my kind of life hacks for you is meditation. So I have learned over the years to actually just like stop and breathe. And if I'd wish that I had discovered meditation 20 years ago.
And do you think that that's made you more confident or more?
Absolutely.
Don't give a shit about the critics or?
I think that comes with age. But I think what does help is, you know, I used to get very, very stressed and a lot of anxiety. I would basically just set off my flight or fight response, you know, and it'd be like a runaway train, right? Like when you can't breathe and you're panicking. And, you know, I would do everything on adrenaline. Like every effort was made with like a huge adrenaline push and a huge stress. And what I've learned to do over the years, when I feel myself set that off, is like be very conscious of that moment, stop, breathe, even if it's like do a breathing exercise for 3 minutes, you completely change your whole nervous system, right? You want to regulate your nervous system, and that changes your thinking.
What's a specific thing that sets you off into that adrenaline rush?
It can be waking up in the morning and looking at my calendar.
And having it be too full?
Yeah, have it be too full. And then you're like, panic, right? I'm rushing. And then, okay, so here's an example. I had a moment the other day where I was really stressed. We're fundraising right now. We're raising the Series C, which is incredibly stressful. I was trying to get Minty on college tours, trying to figure out spring break, trying to, you know, plus, by the way, you know, while we're raising money, we have to do our day job too. I was sitting in my bathroom at home and I was so stressed, I was crying. And I thought, okay, well, this is crazy. So I did a 10-minute meditation and I just lay on the floor and I followed the breathing exercise. I listened to the meditation. After 10 minutes, I completely changed how I felt. And I got up and I was like, wow, I got myself in a crazy state for no reason. And just because I just was breathing and I was much calmer, and I went through the rest of the day completely calm and managed to do everything I needed to do. So 15 years ago, I didn't know about that. I would have spent the whole day in a state of anxiety and pumping cortisol around my system and then feeling toxic and exhausted at the end of the day.
Anything else you use to calm down?
CBD.
Really? What kind?
CBD oil. Lord Jones.
Yeah.
CBD oil. I take that at night with a hot bath with lavender oil. I've discovered
comfort. Every night?
Every night, yeah. I take the tincture, I put it under my tongue, and I'll lay in a hot bath with some lavender oil so it smells nice and it's relaxing. That's kind of my nightly routine to help me, like, just relax before I go to bed. It's like the end of the day.
Do you exercise?
I exercise. And one thing I've discovered recently is Kundalini yoga.
Hmm.
That has been a game changer for me.
How often do you do that?
So right now I do it once a week. But I'd like to do more of it. So apparently when you do Kundalini yoga, it releases oxytocin in your system, which is the chemical you get from being hugged.
And breastfeeding.
Yeah. So the first time I did it, I was in floods of tears. I was like, oh my God, people are going to think something wrong with me in this like yoga class. I literally couldn't stop crying. And then I spoke to the instructor afterwards and she was like, don't worry, I cried for the first 4 years.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. I want to try that. Thank you for being here today, Tamara.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been great. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. That's it for this week's show. We'll see you next Tuesday. This episode was produced by Chris Neary and was edited by Lynn Levy, with mixing by Sam Baer. Our theme song is 9 to 5 by the one and only Dolly Parton. Cut on Tuesdays is a production of Gimlet Media and The Cut.
Support for this show comes from Fundrise. Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes, and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/fox. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.